Stalin had seized a buffer zone from the Baltic to the Black Sea. His aggressive pushing of the traditional Russian interests in the Balkans alarmed Hitler, who was weighing up whether to attack his ally. He decided to invite Molotov to Berlin to sidetrack the Soviets into a push for the Indian Ocean. The night before Molotov left, he sat up late with Stalin and Beria, debating how to maintain the pact. Stalin instructed Molotov to insist on explanations for the presence of German troops in Romania and Finland, discover Hitler's real intentions, and assert Russian interests. Molotov's entire delegation wore identical dark blue suits, grey ties, and cheap felt hats, obviously ordered in bulk. Since some wore the hats like berets, some on the back of their heads like cowboys, and some low over their eyes like mafiosi, it was clear that many had never worn Western headgear before. The tepidity of the visit became obvious when Molotov met Ribbentrop in Bismarck's old office. A rather frosty smile glided over his intelligent chess player's face, noticed a German. When Ribbentrop encouraged Russia to seek an outlet for her energies in warm oceans, Molotov asked, "Which sea are you talking about?" After lunch, the open Mercedes drove Molotov to the Chancellery. Two blonde SS giants threw open the bronze doors of Hitler's magnificent study and formed an archway with impeccable Nazi salutes. The plain, stalwart Russian marched towards Hitler's gargantuan desk at the far end. Hitler hesitated, then walked jerkily to greet the Russians with small, rapid steps. Hitler's theatrical rigmarole to terrorize and impress his guests did not affect Molotov, who regarded himself as a Marxist-Leninist and therefore superior to everyone else, particularly fascists. Hitler treated them to a long soliloquy about his defeat of Britain, generosity to Stalin, and disinterest in the Balkans, none of which was true. Molotov retorted with a series of polite but awkward questions on the relationship between the two powers, pinpointing precisely Finland, Romania, Bulgaria. Their second meeting lasted for a bad-tempered 3 hours. Molotov pressed Hitler for answers. Hitler accused Russia of greed. Nothing dented Molotov's stolid persistence. He noticed that Hitler became agitated. "I persisted. I wore him down." Hitler drew out his handkerchief, wiped the sweat off his upper lip, and saw his guest to the door. "I'm sure history will remember Stalin's name forever," he said.
"I don't doubt it," replied Molotov.
"So we should meet," suggested Hitler vaguely, a meeting that never happened. "But I hope it will remember me, too," he added with mock modesty.
"I don't doubt it," replied Molotov again.
Stalin congratulated Molotov on his defiance of Hitler. "How," he asked, "did he put up with you telling him all this?" The answer was that Hitler did not. Molotov's obstinate Balkan ambitions convinced Hitler that Stalin would soon challenge his European hegemony. Having wavered over attacking Russia, he now accelerated his plans. Whilst Molotov was in Berlin, Hitler signed the directive authorizing Operation Barbarossa, the invasion of the Soviet Union, which was set for May 1941. Just 11 days after Hitler signed the directive, Stalin's spies alerted him to its existence. Stalin knew the USSR would not be ready for war until 1943 and hoped to delay it by frantic rearming and aggressive brinkmanship in the Balkans, but without provoking Hitler. The Führer, on the other hand, realized the urgency of his enterprise and that he had to secure the Balkans before he could attack Russia. Stalin's panic to produce the best weapons and create the best strategy created a new terror around him. The more Stalin realized the powerless condition of his military, the more he floundered, both convinced of his own infallibility and oblivious of his technical ignorance. He supervised every detail of every weapon. His meetings became ever more disturbing, his conduct ever more unhinged. There was a clear etiquette. It was deadly to disagree too much. Veterans advised neophytes on how to behave and survive. Admiral Kuznetsov was about to object to building a fleet of heavy cruisers when another official whispered kindly, "Watch your step. Don't insist." The high command became paralyzed with fear.
Stalin did at least order new plans and urgent war games, but these merely exposed Soviet weakness, which rattled him further. On the 13th of January 1941, he summoned the generals and summarily dismissed Meretskov, the chief of staff. The meeting deteriorated further, when Kulik declared that tanks were overrated. Horse-drawn guns were the future. It was staggering that after two Panzer Blitzkrieg on other countries and only 6 months before the Nazi invasion, the Soviets were even debating such a thing. The next afternoon, General Zhukov, 45, was rushed to the little corner, where Stalin appointed him chief of staff. Zhukov tried to refuse, but Stalin insisted. This quintessential fighting general, who would become the greatest captain of the Second World War, was another Civil War cavalryman, and a protege of Budioni. Georgi Zhukov shared Stalin's ruthless brutality, combining savage reprisals and Roman discipline with carelessness about losses. However, he lacked Stalin's deviousness and sadism. He was emotional and brave, often daring to disagree with Stalin, who, sensing his gifts, indulged him. A few days later, at Kuntsevo, Timoshenko and Zhukov tried to persuade Stalin to mobilize, convinced that Hitler would invade. Zhukov spoke up. Should they not bolster defenses along the western frontier? Are you eager to fight the Germans? Molotov asked harshly. Wait a minute, Stalin calmed the stuttering premier. He lectured Zhukov on the Germans. They fear us. In secret, I will tell you that our ambassador had a serious conversation with Hitler personally, and Hitler said to him, please don't worry about the concentration of our forces in Poland. Our forces are retraining. The generals then joined the magnates for Ukrainian borscht soup, buckwheat porridge, stewed meat, stewed and fresh fruit for pudding, washed down with brandy and Georgian Kavanskara wine. Kulik's imbecilic advice unleashed another paroxysm of terror that would bring death to a Politburo family. On hearing that the Germans were increasing the thickness of their armor, he demanded stopping all production of conventional guns and switching to 107mm howitzers from World War I. The armaments commissar, Boris Vanikov, sensibly opposed Kulik, but lacked his access to Stalin. Kulik won Zhdanov's backing. On the 1st of March, Stalin summoned Vanikov, who explained that it was unlikely the Germans had updated their armor as swiftly as Kulik suggested. The 76mm remained the best. Then Zhdanov entered the office. Look here, Stalin said to him. Vanikov doesn't want to make the 107mm gun, but these guns are very good. I know them from the Civil War. Vanikov, replied Zhdanov, always opposes everything. That's his style of working. Zhdanov accused Vanikov of sabotage. Vanikov shouted back, you're tolerating disarmament in the face of an approaching war. Stalin accepted Kulik's solution, which had to be reversed when the war began. Vanikov was arrested. Only in Stalin's realm could the country's greatest armaments expert be imprisoned just weeks before a war. As the poison spread, it reached Kaganovich's brother. In the almost biblical sacrifice of a beloved sibling, Lazar's steeliness was grievously tested. Vanikov was cruelly tortured and interrogated about his recent post as deputy to Mikhail Kaganovich, Lazar's eldest brother and commissar for aircraft production. Air Force planes crashed with alarming regularity, reflecting the haste and sloppiness of Soviet manufacturing. Vanikov was forced to implicate Mikhail Kaganovich. Meanwhile, Vasily Stalin, now a pilot avid to win paternal love, usually by denouncing his superiors to his father, played his part in this tragedy. Hello, dear father, he wrote on the 4th of March 1941. How's your health? Recently, I was in Moscow on the orders of Rychagov. I wanted to see you so much, but they said you were busy. They won't let me fly. Rychagov called me and abused me very much, saying that instead of studying theory, I was starting to visit commanders, proving to them I had to fly. He ordered me to inform you of this conversation. This subtle denunciation cannot have helped Pavel Rychagov, recently promoted to become chief of the main directorate of the Air Force. He arrived drunk at a meeting to discuss the planes. When Stalin criticized the Air Force, Rychagov shouted that the death rate was so high because you're making us fly in coffins. Silence fell. but Stalin continued to walk around the room, the only sounds being the puffing of his pipe and the pad of soft boots. "You shouldn't have said that." He walked round the deathly quiet table one more time and repeated, "You shouldn't have said that." Richagoff was arrested within the week, along with several other Air Force top brass, and General Stern, Far Eastern commander, all later shot. They, like Vannikov, implicated Mikhail Kaganovich. "We've received testimonies," Stalin told Lazar Kaganovich. "Your brother's implicated in the conspiracy." Mikhail was accused of building the aircraft factories close to the Russian border to help Berlin. Stalin explained that Mikhail, a Jew, had been designated head of Hitler's puppet government-in-waiting, an idea so preposterous that it was either the moronic solipsism of an NKGB simpleton, or, more likely, a joke between Stalin and Beria. "It's a lie," Kaganovich replied. "How can it be a lie?" retorted Stalin. "I've got the testimonies." Stalin ordered a confrontation between Mikhail Kaganovich and his accuser Vannikov, but Lazar was not invited to attend. Mikoyan held the confrontation in his office. Mikhail defended himself passionately against Vannikov. "Are you insane?" he asked his former deputy. "No, you were part of the same organization with me," replied Vannikov. Beria and Malenkov told Mikhail to wait in the corridor while they interrogated Vannikov some more. Mikhail went into Mikoyan's private lavatory, and a shot was heard. By killing himself before his arrest, he saved his family. A scapegoat for the aircraft blunders had been found. Meanwhile, Stalin channeled much of his energy into reasserting Russian influence in the Balkans. By March, Hitler had managed to lure Bulgaria, Romania, and Yugoslavia into his camp. Then, on the 26th of March, the pro-German government of Yugoslavia was overthrown, probably with the help of the NKGB and the British Secret Service. Hitler could not afford such a sore on his flank, so he prepared to invade Yugoslavia, which delayed Operation Barbarossa by a month. On the 4th of April, Stalin threw himself into negotiations with a new Yugoslav government, hoping this glitch in Hitler's plan would either drive Hitler back to the negotiating table or, at the very least, delay the invasion until 1942. He signed a treaty with the Yugoslavs, just as the Wehrmacht began to bombard Belgrade. Yugoslavia was Hitler's most successful blitzkrieg of all. 10 days later, Belgrade surrendered. Events were moving faster than the erosion of Stalin's illusions. That same day, Yosuke Matsuoka, the Japanese foreign minister, arrived in Moscow on his way back from Berlin. Stalin was aware of the priceless benefit of a quiet Far Eastern front if Hitler invaded. Zhukov's successful defense of the Soviet Union's border in the Far East had persuaded Tokyo that their destiny lay southwards in the juicier titbits of the British Empire. When Matsuoka signed a non-aggression pact with the Soviet Union, Stalin and Molotov reacted with almost febrile excitement, as if they had single-handedly changed the shape of Europe and saved Russia. For once, Stalin unwound at the resulting bacchanal and tossed back the champagne with Molotov and Matsuoka. At Yaroslavsky Station, the diplomats assembled to see the minister off were amazed to see an intoxicated Stalin. He was accompanied by Matsuoka and Molotov, who kept saluting and shouting, "I'm a pioneer, I'm ready," the Soviet equivalent of the Boy Scouts' "dib, dib, dib, be prepared." Stalin, who had never before seen any visitor off at the station, hugged the staggering Japanese, but since neither could speak the other's language, their new intimacy was expressed in embraces and grunts of "ah, ah." Then Stalin noticed the tall attaché, Colonel Hans Krebs. "German?" he asked. Krebs stiffened to attention, towering over Stalin, who wrung his hand and said loudly, "We've been friends with you, and we'll remain friends with you." "I'm sure of that," replied Krebs, though the Swedish ambassador thought he did not seem so convinced of it. Japanese diplomats escorted Stalin to his armored Packard, while their ambassador, standing on a bench, waved his handkerchief and cried in a strident voice, "Thank you, thank you!"